Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we are going to be joined by an author who's received all kinds of accolades from different people for his writing, and boy, after I finished his book, I could understand why. And I got his second book, not the first one, but I got the second one, and it was just gripping. My guest today is Robert Jay, and we're going to be talking about Montooth 2. That's right, you're hearing the right word, Montooth 2, Race for the Ryland Ruby. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, I was absolutely intrigued with this when Milton Kahn, whom I've known for years, said, Donna, I really think you would enjoy this material. And I don't do a lot of fiction, but yours was absolutely fascinating. Now, you are a man who's been involved with writing for a lot of years, but give us a little bit of what prompted you to put this series together. Now, there's a Montooth 1, and it's involving a witch called the Canfield Witch, and it's just been recognized by so many organizations for the excellence in writing and your historical information. Give us a little background on how this series came to be.
Well, my previous writings have been of the non-fictional business kind of writing. But when I was in Germany many years ago, around the time the Berlin Wall came down, a little before, a little after, with my family, the family came back about 6 weeks before my tour ended over there. I was a banker in those days. And I had a tradition with my younger daughter, who was 11 at the time, that I used to read to her at night. Well, I couldn't do that when she was gone and overseas, and phone bills were more expensive in those days than they are now. So I just penned her little stories and mailed them every couple of days. So she would get the stories and sort of kept in touch with her that way. Well, she kept those things, and 20 years later, she handed one of them back to me, and she said, I want you to make a book out of this. And these were more or less like fairy tales that I had written. And I thought, well, I don't really have an interest in writing a fairy tale. So I said, no, no, no. But eventually, I thought, well, if I can incorporate that little fairy tale into an action adventure suspense kind of a book, that might be interesting. So I tried to do it, and it seemed like it worked out pretty well. Montooth and the Canfield Witch was the first one. Takes place in Florida Everglades in 1950. And I purposely chose the 50s to write for two reasons. One, I had always sort of in the back of my mind wanted to write a book that involved the Cuban Revolution, which takes place in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And this was a kind of a way to lead into that. So I settled on characters that were about 14 years old in the first book. In the second book, they're about 16, as you know. Mm-hmm. They get older in each book, so that by the time the Cuban Revolution comes around, they're going to be adults, and they'll have some involvement there. I'm not 100% sure exactly who does what, but they'll be involved. And, of course, the main bad guy, whose name is Cruz, he's a Tampa cigar industrialist. He's a Cuban-American, but he's heavily involved with both Batista and Castro. So in Cuba. So that's sort of how I'm getting to where I want to go. And since I now live in Florida, I'm originally a Midwesterner, but I lived in Florida for a long time. And I kind of like the outdoors and whatnot. So I decided to bring the swamps and gators and that sort of thing into the books. And Montooth, in fact, is a gator, a very large alligator with one exceptionally large front tooth. And that's why he's called Montooth or One Tooth. So he actually is in the fable. Yeah, that's what the fable was about. But a gator thought he was a duck because he was hatched by a duck. And he's a fable. He's not real, but he's based on a real character, a real alligator, and the alligator ends up playing a major part in the climax of the book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you did something very unique with your book, which I want to tell you, I thoroughly enjoyed. I am not a prude, but you did not. You wrote a good story, and you don't have, you know, these god-awful horror scenes in it, and also you don't have explicit sex scenes. And you have just gotten all kinds of recognition for the book, but you wanted adults to be able to enjoy it as well as young people. And I think that is a refreshing, refreshing perspective.
Well, I wrote it for adults. It was Clive Cussler is one of my favorite authors, and I kind of wrote it in a sort of the way he writes. He has a little story, usually from ancient times, and in the and that thing is, takes maybe a chapter or two, and then it dies and it's ended. But then it somehow oozes its way back into the main part of the story in modern times, and that's sort of what the fable is all about. But when I was a kid, I went. Of course, I was a kid back in the 40s, and I go to the library, and I wanted a murder mystery. And the librarians, of course, they were more careful in those days, maybe, than they are now. But they, oh, no, you're too young. You're 8 years old, 9 years old. You can't have a murder mystery. Here, we'll give you this mystery over here in the child section. It was like Billy lost his shoe, and where's he going to find it? You
know, boy, is that tame in today's world. Oh, my goodness. They're ready for that when they're two.
So I wanted to write an adult novel, but I intentionally made sure there was no overt sex. I call it Doris Day sex, and that's as much as there will ever be in there, and no bad language, so that a parent who might be a little on the conservative side might not feel bad about handing it to a teenager and saying, yeah, you can read this one. Mm-hmm. So that was my intention, that it would be adults, but that the kids could read it. Well, it's turned out they call it a crossover book because the teenagers have really adopted it, and it's probably almost 60% of the market now, even though they were not the intended audience.
Well, I can see why they would like it, though. I really can, because you've got this progressive patterning with your series, and they can relate to a lot of the things. And the mischief that's done by the young people, it's very, I mean, they're teenagers. This is what they do. But I love your historical information as well regarding Cuba and the environment of Cuba. When we think of Cuba today, it's hard to imagine that it was such a vibrant cultural environment back in the 40s, and that there was so much, you know, even before then. I mean, the music, the dancing, the food, the nightclubs. People would go from Florida. They would go there to have their vacations and just have a wonderful time.
Yes, I can remember my parents going to Havana in about 58 or so before Castro took over, and coming back with not even Super 8, just 8mm film of some of the areas around there. And then, of course, I live near Tampa, and Tampa has a good history with Cubans, and the cigar-making business in Tampa was largely Cuban, Cuban and Italian. And I put quite a bit in the first book. I did put quite a bit of the cigar-making history in Tampa, and which I've always found to be really interesting, not just because I didn't put in the book because it was something to do. I just found it to be interesting to me, so I just researched it a little bit more. I kind of knew things just from being around. And then I researched a little more to make sure I was reasonably accurate with the history. The book has gotten the first book has received some awards in historical fiction, but it really wasn't written for as a history book by any means. But I wanted to bring in part of the history because I'm a history buff, and I thought, well, if the kids do read it, it would be good for them to get an idea of what things were like. And as you know, I footnoted or endnoted all of the most of the products and things from the 50s that I mentioned in the book, because the kids today wouldn't know what Mercurochrome was, for example. So they can go in the back of the book and look that up and say, what in the world is Mercurochrome? That certainly, I would assume you probably have used Mercurochrome when you were a kid, from little scrapes and bruises.
It was no big deal.
Yeah, you slap some of that red stuff on your cut, and it looks like it's worse than it was because of all that red. But it, you know, it's you can't buy it now because it's got mercury in it. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's lots of things in there that I well, that's one of the reasons that I also that I like the 50s for writing is because I didn't want to put bad language or overt sex into it, and that's a good time to choose, good time period to choose if you want to avoid that, because you can have your characters talking, and they don't necessarily have to be throwing out F-bombs every other word, because even though there might have been a little bit off color back in those days, it wasn't as rampant as it is now.
Well, it makes me think when I read, so when I really don't read much with that kind of language in it. However, when I watch movies with that kind of language, I often ask the question, I wonder if the script writers, writers have any vocabulary at all. Because it just, it's gotten to a point where it's like language, I'm sorry, but this is it. And then I heard, I didn't watch the Oscars, but I understood there was a lady, or not a lady, I don't know if she's a lady or not, I can't say it. Anyway, a woman that used that, you know, the improper language, and she was really hit hard. A lot of individuals were really upset with it because she used, I don't think it's colorful language, I think it's inappropriate language. And I think, why is it we have to go this way? So your book is absolutely gripping, and it's so refreshing. Now, let's go into a little bit. You were talking about the cigar making in your first book, Montooth One. And cigar making was really employment for a lot of Cubans. When was that discontinued?
Well, during World War One, cigarette companies shipped a lot of, Lucky Strikes and Camels and that sort of thing over to the GIs. Before that, they were having trouble selling pre-made cigarettes. People would roll their own, men would roll their own especially, but they sort of looked upon the factory-made cigarettes as being kind of sissified. So they were having trouble marketing, but by the time the guys came back from World War One, they've been hooked on the factory-made cigarettes. So when that happened, it started to cause the cigar business to slowly die out. Cigarettes became the preferred method of smoking over cigars, and probably up through into the 40s or so, it kept dwindling and dwindling. And in the case of the book, I had the cigar making industrialist, who's Cruz, and the main bad guy in the book. I had him more or less foreseeing this and selling off his interests in his cigar business, and that's more or less what made it for his fortune.
Now, there are some real plucky young women. Elena is one of them. And then you have Cardi. You have the character Rodrigo. You have Sally Canfield. Now, we have to talk about the Canfield family, because in the first book, you're talking about the Canfield witch. This family had an incredible background that did involve this phenomenal ruby. Give us a little bit of that.
Well, the Canfield witch, I really needed somebody. I needed a treasure in the swamp for my first book. And so I thought, well, how will I get a treasure in the swamp? So then I came across the idea of I would have a person who would be more or less of a recluse in a house near the swamp, and then she would have this treasure. Now, where'd she get a treasure? So I had the family being chased out of Salem in the early 1700s, late 1600s, and then that family migrates to New York and Philadelphia in different times and makes a fortune in shipping and exporting tea and importing tea, rather, and that sort of thing. And then in the process of going to these different cities, the witch rumor keeps following them, so they have to keep moving and moving. Finally, the head of the clan is fed up, and he says, heck with it, we're moving to the swamps of Florida where there is nobody living, so they stop bothering us about being witches. So they move down there, and then they decided that this witch thing really wasn't all that bad. If we want to be left alone and by ourselves, let's let people think we are witches. And so that keeps people away. And Sally Canfield, who's the Canfield witch in the book, is the last of the clan. Many people think she's old, but she's actually only about 29 years old in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's the The Keeper of the Family Fortune, that's buried on the property and is kept in the bank and in the house, but she has no connection whatever to the community in the first book. But because of these young teenagers, she's gradually brought back into society.
Now, Cardi and Elena look a great deal alike. And when you open up your story in Montooth 2, they're in Cuba, and they see Cruz. And in your first book, this guy did some pretty dirty stuff. I mean, he was not a nice guy. And he's still roaming around, and he's got a very strong link with Castro in your story.
Yes, he's actually linked with both Batista and Castro.
Batista,
he's playing both ends against the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he was involved in a major criminal activity that involved Cardi in Florida, and he is in Cuba, and he's trying to make sure that nobody discovers who he was, who he is, rather, that he was involved. So but he's always afraid that the Florida authorities are going to find out and try to extradite him. So he's working with Batista to try to stay prominent as an advisor to Batista, so that if the U.S. tries to get him, Batista will stick up for him and say, no, you can't have him. But he's also a little, well, he's planning ahead. He figures, well, if Batista ever decides to turn me in, maybe I'll work with these revolutionaries. So he's trying to work both sides to keep himself from being extradited to the States for the crimes that he committed that involved the Canfield Witch and Cardi.
Now, you have historical information while you're going through this, and while the story is developing about Batista seizing power, you know, and all kinds of things that, my goodness, the younger generation would have no clue about because they didn't live it. And that's the thing. Stories like yours, because of your historical patterning, you're bringing forth some things that might encourage them to go and research history. When you were doing this book, when you were putting it together, what was your greatest challenge?
Sitting down.
Now that's an answer. Sitting down. Okay.
People ask me, how hard is it to write? I say it's really not hard to write. It's only hard to sit down and type the first word. That's really what keeps me from writing is literally sitting down at the keyboard and starting to type. Once I type the first word, then I just keep going until I usually do it late at night, so I fall asleep at the keyboard. But until I do, I mean, I can just keep going. But it's the will to start that's the hardest part for me, anyway. So that would be the biggest drawback I have is okay, I'm going to go upstairs, going to sit down at the typewriter or keyboard and start going.
Well, you put in some other historical information because you're writing, it's about March 1952, and there is a young man by the name of Mac who had escaped Nazi Germany, and he's ending up in the area of journalism and is given a job by someone because they recognize his talent. But you have in here a statement, inch by inch, small freedom by small freedom. The Nazi sliced another bit of power away from individuals. One day, everyone looked up and realized that the government had all the power, and then it was too late to do anything about it. Some people would read that and say, wow, we're battling that today.
Well, I don't deny this. What I write is a little intended to be a little prophetic. That was pretty much true of what went on in Nazi Germany. People just kept turning their heads at the little slice of freedom that got taken away day after day after day until finally there was none left, and they really had no chance for power at that point. They had stood up at the beginning and said, wait a minute, you can't do this. Possibly Hitler wouldn't have taken over, but obviously once he took over, there was no ability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Much like if you could expand that also for the war itself, if the French and Brits had stood up to him at the beginning instead of trying to negotiate with him, they might have caused the army or somebody to overthrow him at the early stages. But they didn't, and in some ways you can't. I mean, it's easy to go back and say, they should have, But if you look at the environment that they were in coming out of World War One and being just, you know, I don't want anything to do with war, I don't want to do anything, just be nice to people. So I understand it, but you know, it's just the way it is. Some people have said, well, you know, we Clinton should have gone in and blown up all those training sites before 9/11. Well, he couldn't have done that. I mean, really, would the American people have stood for us just going in and obliterating a whole bunch of people in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So even though might not be a big fan of Clinton, I certainly couldn't criticize him for that. It didn't make any sense for him to have done anything that radical at the time. Just like Roosevelt couldn't very well have gone into an attack mode with Japan. They had to wait for something to happen. So that's something like that. That happens, but I'm getting kind of off the track of your question. But yeah, Mac is a refugee from, he's a Jewish young fellow, refugee from Europe, from Germany, and he takes up the journalism pen, and that those were his comments, that his family was run out of the journalism business in Germany.
Cardi is an interesting character, the young woman, because she knows how to track, she knows how to hunt, she knows how to do all kinds of things. Who did you base that character on, your daughter?
Well, my daughter cannot track.
Okay, all right.
She's not physically strong like Cardi is. But mentally, I would say there is a little bit of my daughter Megan in the character. But she's sort of the character probably my daughter would have liked to have been if she could have. But I've got comments in there about Cardi can throw a baseball, which my daughter can do, and she clunks the bad school bully over the head with a baseball at one point, and pretty much takes the bully on periodically, which a lot of the kids have written to me that they really enjoy. I suspect because they face a bully every so often in school. Well, Cardi kind of takes on the bully who's bigger than she is, but she gives him a little judo every so often and knocks him down and beats him up from the third grade on. And he more or less tries to stay away from her now and pick on the little kids, she says. But I would say there's a little bit of my daughter, but it's by no means is it her.
Now, you bring the CIA into your book. You have a character, Novotny, who ends up training young people so that when they're in Cuba, they can spy. And I could see where young people would really grab onto this. Adults would enjoy the reading. But what was this character based on? Who did you pattern Novotny on?
Well, Novotny is... He's East European in origin, but he grows up in New York City. He's a lawyer. Ends up working in Donovan, of course, is the OSS's founder and the forerunner of the CIA, and works in his law firm and is brought into the spy apparatus in World War II. So he's roaming around Eastern Europe and during the war when he comes back to the States, he retires, and then he gets. Ultimately, he's going to get drawn back into the CIA once it starts to gear up again. But as Cardi and Elena want to track Cruz, who's the bad guy, and they don't know who Cruz is at this point. She can recognize him, but they have no idea who he is. So she gets the idea that she and Elena could track him to his house, find out who he is, and then. Turn that information over to the sheriff in Florida, and they can work on extraditing him. So she knows that Novotny was a OSS agent, so she asks for his help. Well, I'm not going to tell you why he does that in the book, because it kind of spoils things, but it seems kind of illogical. Why would this guy teach his kids to go out and track down this literally as murderer, But there's sort of a reason for it, and it's not as kind of far-fetched as it might seem at first glance. You read it, so you know why.
Yes, I did, and I'm not going to give it away either. But I'll tell you one thing that I really got a kick out of was the section where you were talking about how you can put alligators to sleep by rubbing their bellies. That one really did it for me. I just said, oh, yes. I could just see someone saying, oh, come on here, cutie, cutie, cutie. And I'm going to rub your little gator tummy. Yeah. No. I don't think so. Not unless it's about 3 inches long. And even then, they've got a mean bite, those little hummers. But Montooth, which is one of the characters, he is a gator. But there's also another sweet gator called Feather. Yeah, that is in here, and they're used very cleverly. But is that for real?
No.
I didn't think so. Well, folks, if you think we're a little wacky, we are. Montooth 2, Robert J. is my guest. This is The Race for the Ryland Ruby. And there's a fabulous story about the family that owned this ruby, how it came to be, how they got it. There is a little bit of murder in here, investigation, quite a bit of mayhem, unexpected, a wedding, love story, gators that roll over when you rub their tummies. Don't believe that one for a minute. Don't try it. But all of this wonderful, wonderful, diverse, intriguing, interactive story. This is great for young people because there's a lot of good example of intelligent thinking, planning, hard work, evaluation of a person's character. But it's also a good book for adults because of the way the plot weaves. And my goodness, how long did it take you to do Montooth 1, and how long did it take you to do Montooth 2?
It took probably about 3 months to write the first book, but it took me close to 9 months to edit it. Not the proofread, the punctuation of commas and all that sort of thing. That could be cleaned up pretty easily. But I had a horrible time with time. And I would have people doing things before they were born. You know, it just things that didn't make sense time-wise. I wanted the character to do something, but I was paying no attention to when it was being done. Well, he couldn't do that because he's not old enough, or he's too old, or whatever. So that took quite a bit of editing and a lot of rewriting. I learned, since that was the first fiction I'd ever written, I learned that I should write down the birth dates of every person who's a character. So when I wrote the second book, it was a lot faster. There was far less editing because I was able to keep timing in my mind, since I'd realized that was an area of difficulty for me in the first book. So the second one went much faster. And when you write a series, it's in some ways it's a lot easier, in some ways it's more difficult. It's easier because you got all these characters that are already there. You don't have to keep describing them and bringing out what they're like because they're already there. But it's harder because you got to make sure that you make sense and you stay in the their continuity is still there. So, but that I don't have too much difficulty with. Timing is still probably the biggest difficulty for me, is because I just want people to do things, and then wait a minute, you can't have them do it then. You can't have somebody else do that because the guy isn't the right person at that point in time.
Well, you bring out so many various interesting positionings, like George Washington saying, few men have virtue to withstand the highest bidder. And as part of the story, young Mac is being advised, let us hope that our political people have more moral fiber to avoid trying to buy votes and that the people have the sense to recognize a voter bribe for what it is. You also have information here on Batista and what he did to give the rebels generous treatment that taught Castro a lesson he remembered well when he ultimately gained power 6 years later. Never, ever be gentle with political opponents. Well, this and much, much more. It's just absolutely a fabulous book to read. There are so many interesting and intriguing portions. And this is book 2 of a series of 5. Montooth 2, his website is montoothbooks.com. That's MONTOOTH books.com. Robert J., keep up the good work, and congratulations on a second in your series, and I look forward to the third.
Early 2012, it should be out.
Oh, great. You'll have to send me a copy.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Robert. This is Donna Sebo again. Montooth 2, Race for the Ryland Ruby. Go to his website, montoothbooks.com, and find out more. Great reading. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
It's time to get your glow on at the Northwest Women's Show, a show that's all about you. 400 exhibits, 4 entertainment stages, fascinating seminars, and best of all, shopping, shopping, shopping. New this year is the Glow Experience. 5 fun and easy steps to help you make the most of your time at the show. Meet Terry Haas from HGTV's Design to Sell, Polly Klein, famous animal communicator, dance diva Chris Linares, who will help you unleash all the power you need to dance your own dance. Plus fun and trendy fashion shows from JCPenney, favorite authors Anne and Leslie Rule. And they're back! Seattle's hottest firefighters. Bring your mom, your daughter, your sister, your friends. The Northwest Women's Show, sponsored by Drugstore.com, American Family Insurance, BECU, Como TV, Beauty.com, and Green Smoke. It's electric. Get your glow on at Questfield Event Center March 4th through 6th. The Northwest Women's Show, it's such a girl thing. For show information, go to nwwomenshow.com.
Hi, this is Rio. I'm the author of the cutting-edge book, Hooked on Raw. I want to give you and your loved ones the gift of optimum health. So when you order my book, Hooked on Raw, which has over 350 delicious, healthy recipes, I'll include my new DVD, What's Not Cooking in Rio's Kitchen, for a half price. Just go to my website, rawfoodinfo.com, and click on Holiday Special. That's rawfoodinfo.com. Click on Holiday Special.
This is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open if you want to give me a buzz at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, today, the newsletter went out, and it will be up on my website in short order, but I wanted to let you know that it is available, and I have been getting some very interesting comments because my editorial is about Bill Gates and something that he presented in a speech that I think you'll find very interesting. So if you want to see the newsletter, all you have to do is go to my website, DelphiInternational.com. That's DelphiInternational.com. And that should be posted. If not today, it'll be there by tomorrow. And then I wanted to let you know that we have got a real great interview, and that is going to be, oh my goodness, I found out I did something incorrect. I reversed my guests. I was supposed to have Dr. Kerkorian today. Well, we've got Montooth 2 today, so I'm going to be having Dr. Kerkorian tomorrow, and then Analog Brain in a Digital World, Greg Tamblyn, is going to be on with us on Thursday. So I wanted to let you know about that, and that is music, and it's just absolutely wonderful. Greg is a musical comedian. So Dr. Kerkorian is going to be on tomorrow, and I apologize because that is my mistake. So anyway, we have got phone lines open, 888-815-9756. Donna Sebo here, and I wanted to share with you some information about the Cumaean Sibyl. Now, Sibyls were known as people of prophecy capabilities. And ancient Rome at one time had 10 of these prophetesses who, in their belief system, channeled what they considered divine energy. Now, these Sibyls were in Persia, Libya, Samos, Cimmeria, Ethria, Tiber, Marphasis, Phygia, Delphi, and Cumae. Now, Delphi is something that many people are very familiar with. But one of the best known is the Cumaean Sibyl. Now, she lived near Naples in the 5th century B.C., She lived in a cave, which was said to lead directly to the underworld, as their beliefs were. And it was rediscovered in 1938 2. The passageway was 375 feet long, and just like the priestess at Delphi, and she was in a very enclosed environment, and she would be up on a chair over a massive, massive hole that apparently had a, what I want to call like a smoke that would come up and would cause her to go into trance. Well, that was Delphi. Well, the Cumaean Sibyl gained her powers through association with the god Apollo. And she said the god Apollo offered her anything if she would spend time with him. She asked for eternal life, but she neglected to ask for eternal youth. And consequently, she shriveled, as legend has it, into a shadow. Now, apparently, this Sibyl wrote her prophecies on leaves that she would place at the mouth of her cave. If no one came to pick them up, then the wind would scatter them to the four corners. Now, the Sibylline verses told Romans how to gain favor with foreign gods, and they eventually were bound into 9 volumes, which the Sibyl tried to sell to the Roman king, Tarquin. Well, he didn't want to pay the price, so she burned 3 of the books. He felt her price was still too high. He laughed at her, and she burned 3 more books. And when she returned with the last 3 books, the king said, well, maybe there's something I should be aware of in these last 3, so he bought them. Now, these books apparently were kept in the Roman capital and consulted until some were destroyed in a fire in 83 BC, and then the rest survived until another fire in AD 405, at which time Romans, who were extremely enterprising, decided they were going to write pseudo-Sibylline prophecies. A little bit of history there. Fascinating stuff. You just never know who's going to come up with what or why they are going to do that, that they do. It's one of those things that is, I think, fascinating about human beings. People will come up with concepts or ideas, and someone will say, I wonder how I can improve on that. Yeah, remember the old psychic hotlines? I think there might be a few of them still around, but for a long, long time, that was a very, very industrious enterprise that a lot of people utilized. The ones that were the readers on the phone lines didn't make very much money. In fact, they didn't make much money to speak of at all. However, those that organized the particular activity, many of them became very, very wealthy because of it. But that has passed out of favor, hasn't it? Talent. All of us have a talent or two, and it is something that if we're willing to work with it and we're willing to give the best of what we have, sometimes we are going to absolutely surprise ourselves at how we can accomplish things. There was a man that had a talent for recognizing beautiful violins. His name was Luigi. As an Italian, he just absolutely loved finding antiques. And he purchased instruments that he knew absolutely were of the finest quality. No one knew about this passion of his until he died. When his estate was appraised, they found 246 extremely valuable violins in his attic. One of the most expensive of these violins had been hidden in the drawer of an old dresser. He had found a Stradivarius. He had purchased it from someone who had also bought it solely as a collector's item. There was someone that made an observation after this phenomenal find had happened. They said, in preserving the instrument the way he had, keeping it in a drawer, and there was a W.Y. Fullerton that made this comment, he said, Tiresio had robbed the world, Luigi, had robbed the world of beautiful music the whole time. He treasured his violins and had them up in his attic. But you know what? Others had done it also. Remember, he had bought it through some kind of an estate sale and or an antique store. By the time this great Stradivarius violin was discovered that had been in his drawer in his house and was finally played, 147 years had passed. That violin hadn't seen the light of day, so to speak, for 147 years. And it's something that often we say, gee, isn't it a shame? Perhaps it is. But on the other hand, I look at it and I say, aren't we fortunate that someone loved it so much that they took good care of it? The antique collectors that we have around us in the world take good care of what they have typically. They don't let it rust and rot. They want it to be something that can be enjoyed, and they are caretakers. And I think it's marvelous. Look at how many things have been destroyed because someone didn't care for it, or because of a natural disaster, or fires, any number of things. This gentleman, when he died, had no clue about the value of what he had. All he knew was is that he loved it. So even though he was criticized by many, perhaps thought as a hoarder, I don't know that he was a hoarder. I think in his own way, he was enjoying something that was so beautiful to him that he could not ever do himself, but it gave him a great deal of pleasure to know that he could see it, he could look at it, even though he could never play it. I think the sad thing is that he didn't have a will or something that enabled him to give it to somebody or to something or an institution so it could be taken care of just as carefully as he did. But then that's just my 50 cents worth of operation, observation. What I would say to you is this. Remember, you are a person that has a great deal of talent. I don't care if it's baking the best chocolate cake on the planet, or if it's telling stories, or if it is doing whatever that you really like. Your talent is there for the purpose of being used. And one of the things about we human beings is that when we can use our talents to the best of our capabilities, we will find that we're going to be enriching not only our own lives, but the lives of the people around us. And it's so, so important that we do that. Don't hide your talents. If you know your strengths, use them. Enable other people to see them so that they can enjoy them. If nothing else, volunteer your time. I have a relative in our family who is one of the finest organizers I've ever known. And she went to do some volunteer work at a hospital. And they didn't want to have her leave. They wanted to give her a job full time. She was incredible. She straightened up a chaos that had existed for years. She did it in under 6 months. Her talent, organization. We all have our talents, and you just need to be aware of the fact that whoever you are, wherever you are needed. You are very important, and you are going to find that you have something very, very special to offer. But if you don't use it, nobody's going to know about it. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. Don't forget now with the Pacific Northwest Women's Show, for those of you listening in the Seattle area and surrounding sections of the Washington state, by golly, we're going to have a fabulous event, and I hope that you will join us. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, this event is going full steam ahead. We have 25,000-plus women that come out. And there is something going on every hour of the show, and you will have the time of your life. Now, I'm going to be in booth number 407. I invite you to join me at my women's forum on Friday because I'm going to have six dynamic speakers from 11 to 12. We're going to be talking about health and wellness. From 1 to 2, we'll be talking about animals. From 2 to 3, we're going to be talking about the law and how it affects domestic violence victims, as well as juveniles. So we've got a lot that's going to be shared. And then on Saturday, I'm going to be talking about the psychic mind and you at 1:30 on Saturday and 1 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. So I hope to see you there. And do stop by booth number 407. I'd love to meet you. And I just know that you're going to have the time of your life. It's getting closer and closer. It's getting really, really exciting. Do you realize that 43% of adults think they spend too much time online? 64% of adults think the kids spend too much time online. And 18% of adults have organized or consider a tech-free day. In the average household, there are 20 digital devices. It is incredible. And you know, we take so much of this for granted. We don't really think about it too much, but it is there. So I want you to be aware, it's going to become even more so. I saw a program that was showing stuff. In fact, I got an email, and I may include it in my April newsletter. It just was amazing. And my friend who sent it to me, she said, "This is the future. It's a little scary." And I said, "Nope, not if you watch three of Arnold Schwarzenegger's movies, Recall, Instant Recall, The Running Man, and also there was another one that he did that was sci-fi. And in each one of these, they had portrayals of what was being depicted in this video that was sent to me. Absolutely amazing. Just incredibly amazing. So this is something, our lives are changing more rapidly than we could ever have dreamed. Donna Sebo, we are taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
We're back. The Northwest Women's Show with 400 exhibits, entertainment, seminars, the Glow Experience, fashion shows, and shopping, shopping, shopping. Meet HGTV's Terry Haas, animal communicator Polly Klein, and Seattle's hottest firefighters. March 4th through 6th at Quest Field Event Center. The Northwest Women's Show. It's such a girl thing. Show information at nwwomenshow.com.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. I've got some various information that people shared with me, so I thought I would just put it out there to see if maybe you would benefit from it. One, and this one I love, this is on jelly beans. Well, I want you to know, there is a jelly bean cure. I know, you hear of just about everything. Well, this is a jelly bean cure. Well, also, you can have a chocolate-covered peanut or a fake pill, candy pill, to ease your aches and pains. Okay, I am not making fun of you. I am just saying, this is something that I came across, and I just shook my head. But there is a study done by the Harvard Medical School. They say it's good medicine. In their study, done with doctors at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, 59% of irritable bowel syndrome patients who took two sugar pills a day that they knew were phony. In fact, the candy sugar pills had the word placebo printed on them. That's right. Reported that they experienced significant relief from their painful symptoms, the same result as could be expected from taking a real medication. The simple act of taking a medication, real or fake, helps activate the body's own healing powers. And this came from an Oriental medicine expert, Ted Kepchuk. The mind, isn't it amazing? I mean, just two jelly beans? What if you can choose your flavors? You probably can. Or chocolate-covered peanuts. It is amazing what that can do. There are so many things that we have yet to really totally completely comprehend about the body's capacity for making chemicals. Chemicals that can make us better. It's absolutely amazing. Also, they did another report. They said if you're one of the 37 million Americans plagued by painful sinus infections, the doctors now are starting to say, that helps the sinuses. I'm not joking. This is for real. They said if you hum for 5 seconds, it improves the airflow between your sinuses, your nasal cavities, and boosts the production of nitric oxide, a gas that relaxes blood vessels in your nasal passages 15-fold. Now, what is the result of this? By doing this humming, a reduction occurs in the blockages in your sinuses and the inflammation also that can lead to infection. You know, they're finding today that inflammation in the body causes so many problems, and we're going to be having a guest coming on the air that will talk about a cardiologist who's going to be coming up in the next couple of weeks that said that as a cardiologist, and he's done a lot of heart surgeries, inflammation is the primary cause for plaque and arterial blockage. Fascinating stuff. So anything that can reduce inflammation is going to be a good thing. Now, I don't know about you. Do you check your vehicle, the oil, the fluids that need to be kept at proper levels in your car? Well, I've never been a big one on doing that, but I've started doing it, and I try to do it about once a month. And if you do that, then you're going to find that if your oil level is dropping a little bit, you fill it up, and it's going to keep going like the Energizer Bunny. Well, there is traditionally an attitude that's been promoted by mechanics that when you get close to your 3,000-mile mark on your odometer, you're going to need to have an oil change. Well, apparently, that's not necessary. You can save up to $90 a year by waiting 2 to 3 times longer for an oil change. Now, if you have an older car, you know, if you're a person that likes to drive classics, or your car was in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s, you may still want to look at that very thoughtfully. But in the models that were manufactured 2000 and beyond, they find they can be driven 7,500 to 10,000 miles. And older cars, the ones that I mentioned, they can go as long as 5,000 miles without an oil change. But you need to be sure that you keep your oil level at the proper point. And all you need to do is consult your owner's manual, especially if you have a newer car, to find out how many miles your car can go and what type of oil will make it last. Also, don't hesitate to talk to your mechanics, because it really makes a good, well, makes a good impression, number one. And two, they often can give you some excellent tips about products that can keep your car in good condition. And because we've had such severe weather conditions, your oil in your car can act differently than it does, let's say, in more moderate temperatures. So be sure and check with your mechanic, because I know so many people are still encased in snow. And my experience was up in Alaska whenever I was up there and they had below zero weather. You really had to be very, very careful because the viscosity of your oil and many other components that are utilized in keeping a car really running well change dramatically. So you have to pay attention to that. This is Donna Sebo, and we have got just a little bit more time. Tomorrow, my guest is going to be Dr. Kerkorian. We're going to be talking about Obi's wisdom. And I am also going to be talking with Greg Tamblyn, some good music. And don't forget, on Friday, we're going to be having a best of Donna. So I look forward to entertaining and having a wonderful time with the speakers that I'll be having there on Friday. And I know you'll be pleased with the guests that we have. This is just a dynamic time of the year. don't worry. Spring is coming. It's going to be here before you know it. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. If you can, check out my newsletter on DelphiInternational.com, and I look forward to being with you again tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on BBSRadio.com. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.